today on Against the Grain, a look at the nature and impact of colorism, that is, bias and discrimination based on skin color. Nikki Khanna has written about colorism globally, its causes, and how it's experienced by Asian American women. I'm CS. We'll represent a conversation with the University of Vermont-based sociologist coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Racism is a word we hopefully don't need to define. Colorism, well, that term is far less used. That phenomenon gets far less attention. If people with fairer skin are considered superior, and they are in this and many other countries, does that mean that people of color with lighter skin are favored, are privileged, are less likely to experience discrimination? And if the answer is yes, what should we know about the nature and impact of judgments made on the basis of skin tone, both between races and within ethnic communities? It's a fascinating and disturbing dynamic that plays out in many parts of the globe and in the U.S. In her new book, Whiter, Nikki Khanna explores both the global reach of colorism and the ways in which skin color discrimination is specifically directed toward and found among Asian Americans. According to Khanna, colorism is a repressive, sexist, and racist practice that disadvantages much of the world's population. Nikki Khanna is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Vermont. Her new book is Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. When Khanna joined me recently, I began by asking her to define colorism.
Colorism is discrimination that one might experience because of their skin color. So we oftentimes talk about colorism occurring within racial groups or within ethnic groups. And so it's those intra-group dynamics that is basically what we're talking about.
But couldn't colorism, doesn't that operate between racial groups as well? I mean, that people who are lighter skinned would feel a certain bias against people with darker skin?
Yes, absolutely. So it can go both ways, and it really depends on the racial group. So much of the research has been conducted on African-American communities, and we sort of see the bias going two directions. When we talk about colorism, we are oftentimes talking about bias against darker-skinned individuals, but we certainly see within or among African-Americans bias against those with lighter skin as well, because skin color within the African-American community is tied up with not only perceptions of beauty and an intelligence, but also authenticity. So being light-skinned and being perceived perhaps by others with darker skin as not being, authentically Black or not Black enough. So we do see it happen in both directions. And I also want to add as well, one of the things I just said was colorism occurs within groups. We oftentimes research and talk about it as happening within a racial group or within an ethnic group, but we also see it happening between different racial groups as well. And we can talk more about that, but I just want to put that out there.
To what extent does colorism parallel or track racism?
So the way I oftentimes talk about it, and even other scholars have talked about it, is that they are closely related terms. You probably wouldn't have colorism exist without racism. And so I know some scholars have talked about them as being perhaps cousins. I talk about them as being parent and child. So racism being the parent and colorism being the child, sort of stemming from racism. Because when we talk about racism in particular, we're talking about it built on white supremacy, veneration of whiteness, and colorism flows from that. So within ethnic communities, for example, the emphasis or adulation, veneration, you might call it veneration, placed on having light skin is actually rooted in a broader racism. So they're certainly very closely related concepts.
What privileges come with having light skin, lighter skin in the U.S.?
So in the United States, when we think about having light skin, there's a lot of privileges. So research in particular points to a For example, individuals having better health, greater job prospects, higher status occupations, higher earnings, so on and so forth. But the privileges sort of more tangibly that we might talk about on a day-to-day basis is you're seen as smarter. You're seen as more beautiful, especially if you're a woman. You're seen as more trustworthy. So there are all these characteristics that we ascribe to people with lighter skin in the U.S., but also around the world as well. And I think this is what makes colorism so interesting, is it really is a worldwide phenomenon. And in my book, I'm specifically talking about it within the context of the United States and the impact from Asia, but it is worldwide, affecting many groups around the world.
Yeah, let's talk about some parts of the world that you bring up in the introduction to your book, Whiter. How strong is the preference for, and it might be called obsession with, light skin in a place like Japan?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that coming into this project, my sort of knowledge base was based on people from India, Indian Americans. And I knew this was an issue that affected people in Eastern Asia, for example, Japan, even in China and Korea, so on and so forth. I thought going into this project that it must affect them to a lesser degree than it may affect people in South Asia or Southeast Asia. But what I found was it was almost identical, sort of parallel. And there might be different reasons. I talk about in the book different reasons for why there's such an emphasis placed on light skin in those communities or in those countries in particular. But it's just as prevalent an issue in places like Japan, in places like China, in places like Korea that it is in South and Southeast Asia as well.
And so there is a distinct, social preference for lighter skin among Japanese people? And if that's true, what do many Japanese women do with that pressure to look whiter?
Right. So walking into a department store, for example, and looking at the makeup counters in the United States, you're likely going to see products, facial products, for example, skincare products aimed at women that have a lot to do with anti-aging properties. If you were to walk into a department store in Japan, for example, you're going to see probably just as many products, but the emphasis is going to be more on whitening and lightening and brightening. There's all these different terms that are used. So there's a pressure placed on women to buy into these products that they would take home and, you know, put on your face, put on your body to lighten your skin. So that pressure that we see in Japan is one actually we would see across Asia. So, you know, similar types of products, and actually it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And so when we think about today what Japanese women might do to deal with that pressure, oftentimes it has to do with buying into these skin whitening products.
So we're talking about creams and soaps and other products. Are there also things that doctors do surgically or claim to be able to do surgically to make someone look whiter?
Absolutely. So some offices, for example, dermatology offices might prescribe you pills that they tout as having skin whitening properties to help you lighten your skin. So you take it internally. Or laser operated machines where they might advertise as if you come into our office, we can help lighten your skin perhaps in just under an hour. You might be paying hundreds of dollars for such a treatment, but these types of treatments are becoming more and more in demand as technology is sort of moving along with this pressure of colorism.
Yeah, in this book, you cite a source saying that in Taiwan, more than half of all women pay big money to lighten their skin. I mean, that's astounding to me.
I actually talk about in the book, even besides the laser-operated machines, it's, you know, you could walk into the store and you find skin whitening moisturizers and foundations and anti-aging serums and sunscreens and lip balms. The list just goes on and on, all the way down to like foot creams and, you know, soap bars and facials are the most common, but even in places like India, there are things like whiten your underarms with a whitening deodorant or whitening even other private areas of your body. So the pressure is pretty immense.
Tell us about the use of Caucasian models in Asia, throughout Asia, to advertise products to people who live there.
It's very common to see white women, Caucasian women, models used to advertise not only skin whitening products or beauty products, but also all sorts of products from sunglasses to footwear to clothing. So you might, for example, see a Caucasian woman being used in these ads, or you might see mixed race women who have some degree of Asian ancestry, but also white ancestry. So, you know, as you're driving down the road, you might see on the billboards, for example, white women or mixed race, white Asian women advertising products to you on a daily basis. You open up a magazine, you might see, again, white women or white appearing women, mixed race, Asian white women there as well. Not just fashion magazines, but any type of magazine where you might see ads for different products. So it's pretty pervasive. One of the examples I give in the book was for Lancome. And Lancome, for several years, advertised a whitening serum in Asian markets, and they used Emma Watson as the face of that. Emma Watson, for many people, might recall that she was in the, you know, Harry Potter films, and she's a Caucasian woman. I think that she got a lot of blowback because of, you know, her face being on these Lancome products. But this is pretty common in Asian markets to see white women advertising these products to Asian women.
Her name is Nikki Khanna. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Vermont. And we are talking about her new book, Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. It's published by NYU Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You referred, Nikki, to the aspiration, the desire to be whiter or lighter in India, and that makes me think of colonization. What did European colonization in countries like India and the Philippines, another country that you bring up in your book, what impact did that have, or might that have had, on how people viewed whiteness?
So that's such a good question. There's a lot of debate within Asian American communities, for example, among Indian Americans and among Indians and Filipinos as well, about where did this preference for light skin arise? Where did it come from? Some make the argument that, you know, this existed long before European colonization. And certainly within the case of India, this may in fact be true, that long before the British arrived to India, for example, there already was a preference in place for having light skin or white skin. But certainly we cannot divorce the pressure of having light skin in these societies from colonialism. And so one of the things I talk about in the book with regard to the Philippines and India as two examples is that certainly colonialism exacerbated the problem. And a problem perhaps maybe was already there, but absolutely exacerbated. So when the British arrived to India, they would oftentimes make comparisons between light skin and dark skin Indians. And they would talk about lighter skinned Indians as being more attractive and more intelligent. But even more than that, they would empower lighter skinned Indians and sometimes part white individuals during their rule. So, for example, giving them more prestigious jobs and government positions and industry and education, while darker skinned individuals were left with more subservient jobs to their British masters, so to say. So we certainly can't divorce this issue of colorism from colonization.
You point to a survey in three North India states. The survey showed that light skin was the most important criterion when choosing a mate. And you also write about darker skinned women in India and in the Philippines as being encouraged to marry lighter. How much pressure might that involve, or who's sending those messages to these women to marry lighter? And does this also impact Asian American women?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. So in terms of who's putting the pressure, oftentimes the pressure comes directly from family. So we see colorism, that message being sent through media outlets, as you know, as I said before, you know, you might see on the side of a billboard a white woman advertising a particular product to Asian women. You see it on TV, you see it in the commercials, you see it in the whitening creams. But oftentimes that pressure to marry lighter or marry whiter, or the pressure to whiten your skin so that you will be, you know, more quote unquote attractive on the marriage market, that oftentimes comes from within family. So mothers and grandmothers in particular. And what was really interesting is in the book and many of the essays, women talked about sometimes their conflicted relationships with their own mothers over this issue of, you know, you should lighten your skin, or grandmother saying that no one's going to marry you because you're so dark. And so we see women as transmitting that message, but it's because those women have learned to live within this culture where light skin has been put up on a pedestal. They've learned to live within these norms, and they want the best for their children, their grandchildren, their nieces. So they're telling them, stay out of the sun, use this whitening soap. Here, I bought you a whitening cream. They want them to be successful. They want them to marry well. But it's they who are also transmitting this message generation after generation. So that's pretty problematic. I will say, however, there were some women in the book who talked about how they were working actively to counter this message for their own children. So they might have talked about how their moms pressured them to use a certain cream or wear a hat when they went outside, but to also talked about at the same time how they had young girls of their own or envision themselves down the road having young girls and how they would parent differently. So it's certainly interesting to see, or for us to think about, if this cycle is starting to maybe halt in some way, or at least being challenged in some way.
Let's say you do have a mother or a grandmother who feels very strongly that whiter is better and will lead to a better life for their daughter or granddaughter. And that's based on their maybe traditional culture back in India or in China or in Cambodia. There is also, as you said, the additive effect of, in the U.S., the kind of racism and anti-Black sentiment, prejudice, bias.
Absolutely. There is a second pressure that's happening in the U.S. for Asian American women. So I talk about it in the book as being a double whammy, so to say, for Asian American women. So within their cultures, there's a pressure within their Asian ethnic cultures, there's a pressure for having light skin or towards having light skin and perhaps using some of these products to make that happen. But also within larger American society, there is a pressure towards having light skin. And I talk about my own experience growing up in the United States. So, yeah, you know, you grow up in a culture where the women who primarily grace the covers of the magazines you read, for example, the teen magazines I read when I was a kid or the fashion magazines I read now, are still predominantly light-skinned women. You might see women of color on these magazines. They tend to be exceptions rather than the rule. They also tend to be women who are famous for other reasons. For example, maybe they're singers, you know, famous singers like Beyonce or Rihanna, for example. But when we look at who's modeling many of the products that we're buying, they are light-skinned women. And I also talk about just doing a Google search online, and I would invite anyone to do this from home, is just go online and do a some sort of internet search on, I typed in beautiful women, and what came up were primarily light-skinned, white-appearing women. And so what is this telling us about who we consider to be beautiful? Certainly it's telling us that light skin, white-appearing women are sort of the gold standard or epitome of beauty. And so there's a pressure on women who don't fit that mold, Asian American women, but also African American women and other racial groups as well. So there is definitely a double pressure that women who are writing in this book are talking about or sort of feeling and experiencing.
And I'm reading from my guest Nikki Khanna's new book, Whiter. The growing body of research on colorism among African Americans, Latinx populations in the U.S., and Asian Americans reveals that one's shade of skin is linked to educational attainment, employment, occupational status, income, wealth, physical health, mental health, and marriageability, as well as perceptions of intelligence, social class, trustworthiness, and attractiveness. Your book, Nikki, focuses on women. Does colorism operate on, is it experienced differently by women as opposed to men?
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted this really to just be a platform specifically for women. I mean, I think the interesting thing about colorism is it does affect all genders, but I argue that it is women who really bear the brunt, because in addition to people's perceptions, you know, based on their skin color, their sort of their intelligence, their trustworthiness, are also these perceptions of physical beauty and femininity. And for women on marriage markets, this is really important. For example, I talk a lot about India, but also Pakistan, other parts of South Asia, where having light skin is extremely important. And so, you know, one of the things I do talk about was growing up and reading the India Abroad, which is a newspaper that serves the Indian American community. And you would see ads placed by parents for their adult children, because parents would oftentimes, they were the matchmakers, or, you know, who were looking for potential mates for their adult children. And they would, you know, if they were advertising for their daughter, would oftentimes say, my daughter is beautiful and she's fair. My daughter's beautiful and she's wheatish, which literally meant you had skin color that was the color of wheat, and that was seen as beautiful because it was light skinned. But men, you didn't see that same thing. In fact, if you looked at the ads that parents might have placed for men, or, you know, their adult male children, they would say things like, you know, handsome son looking for fair, attractive girl. So, you know, asking for light skinned women to, perhaps apply to send their bio data, as you would say, to see if they would be eligible mates for their sons. So for women in particular, this is especially important.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Nikki Khanna joins me, K-H-A-N-N-A. She teaches sociology at the University of Vermont. She's author of Biracial in America, Forming and Performing Racial Identity. We are talking about her new book, Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. The book features 30 essays written by Asian American women about their experiences with skin color, privilege, and discrimination in the U.S. and within their respective Asian American communities. Why focus, Nikki, in this book on specifically Asian American women?
So I specifically want to focus on Asian American women because of what I had mentioned before is this double whammy for women in terms of the pressures for having light skin. So again, that pressure from their Asian ethnic communities that might come from their parents, in particular their mothers and their grandmothers, to have light skin, but also that pressure in the United States to have that sort of more European look. I talk a lot about not just skin lightening and the pressure for having light skin, but also for East Asian women to have a certain eye shape, and many women undergoing surgery, going under the knife to get that sort of double eyelid look that really resembles that of European Americans. For many, the conventional thought is, well, you know, they live in America, we have different beauty standards, it must be better for them. And in some ways, it absolutely is. But I talk about the pressure in Asia as being very overt. We see the pressure here, I believe, is just as strong, it's just much more covert. So, you know, for Asian American women, they're not necessarily going to see a billboard ad on the side of the street that tells them to buy a whitening cream, but they are going to feel a great deal of pressure to conform to European American beauty standards, in addition to those pressures within their own communities as well.
For those Asian American women, and there are many of them, who do want lighter skin, does this mean necessarily mean that they see racial whiteness as the ideal, as the thing to be approximated?
Absolutely not. So I think that there is a large debate among Asian Americans and among scholars who study colorism among Asian Americans or among Asian communities, what this actually means. Does this mean that women want to be white? Not necessarily. In some cases, I do talk about in the book how for some, it is about aspirational whiteness, that there's a lot of things we link to whiteness in American society, such as upward mobility, assimilation, as also being sort of like a true American citizen or a true American. But that's not really necessarily the case for all women. Because within different Asian ethnic cultures, whiteness means different things. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you want to be Caucasian, but it might mean that you want to appear to look like a quote-unquote rich Asian. Joanne Rondila is also another scholar who works in this area, and she talks about how it's about, you know, wanting to look wealthy, of a higher social class. And so we sort of have those two things going on. And so it doesn't mean that if a woman is putting on this whitening cream, she necessarily wants to be like a white woman, although that is the case for some. But it could also mean that she just wants to appear to be of a higher social class within our own Asian ethnic circles.
Many of the women who contributed essays to your book have dark or pretty dark skin. What kinds of negative treatment have they, some of them, experienced as a result?
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting is they talk about their experiences growing up in the United States and the negative treatment they've received from other Americans, in particular other white Americans, but also from other Asians within their own Asian ethnic communities. So they might talk about pressure from mothers or other women, even men within the community who say, you know, you should use this soap, or send them messages like one individual I'm thinking of talked about how when she was really young, she noticed that her grandmother was watching her as she was playing. And as she looked up, her grandmother sort of said, you know, something along the lines of like, I'm really sad because no Filipino man is going to want to marry you. And so you're learning about the stigmatization of your skin from family members and from members within your own community. However, at the same time, women also talked about the ways in which they were treated primarily because of racial reasons and because they were sort of othered within American society. So a lot of women talked about racial slurs or physical harassment towards them, or, you know, kids, common was kids sort of pulling their eyelids up to basically perform what they thought was mimicking Asian eyes, for example. So there are a lot of different stories, but the stories are coming both from other Americans and other Asian Americans as well.
What does or might Islamophobia have to do with how darker-skinned Asian Americans are treated in the U.S.?
A great deal, certainly since 9/11 in 2001. So, you know, I think when we talk about South Asians and Southeast Asians, well, I'd say, first of all, for all Asian Americans, there's certainly a certain type of otherness that's ascribed to them, as if they're maybe perhaps not really American. Certainly, we've seen this in getting a lot of news coverage lately about, you know, go home to your country, for example. But I also talk about those with darker skin face that added pressure of or added backlash of resembling people who maybe are from the Middle East or might be Muslim, for example. You know, there are some Indians and some from South Asia and Southeast Asia who are Muslim. They may or may not be Muslim, but are facing the same sort of Islamophobic backlash. So it's sort of like an added pressure and a scariness in a society that, you know, certainly post 9/11 has made it very difficult for people of dark skin who might be perceived as Muslim.
Nikki, some listeners who might be hearing about this colorism, this bias and prejudice against people with darker skin might think, well, what about tanned skin? I mean, isn't tanned, and therefore darker, skin seen positively in the U.S.? And doesn't that mean that some Asian American girls and women don't feel as much pressure to be light-skinned?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I think this is something I've thought a lot about as well, because, you know, personally, I have light skin. I talk about this in the book. And in the summers, I would love to be out in the sun to get darker skin. But I talk about it as in the book as being a false parody. So oftentimes when I talk about colorism to other people, especially to other non-Asians, they'll say, well, yeah, you know, it's like everyone wants something they don't have. Asian American women, yeah, they might want to have lighter skin, but hey, I as a white woman want to have darker skin. So oftentimes equating the two, but really that is a false comparison. Because when women access light skin, or when women, you know, put on these whitening creams to access light skin, they're also trying to access power and privilege. They want to be seen as wealthier than they are, as a higher social class. So they oftentimes do it for the purposes of social mobility. Whereas in the U.S., tanning doesn't have that same sort of power. You know, if I tanned in the summer, it wasn't because I was trying to access something that was unavailable to me. I wasn't trying to access social mobility. I did it because I thought it looked good. This does not mean to say that America somehow more values darker skin than Asia does. Maybe to some extent that could be true, but I think there's a fine line between tanning versus having dark skin. And, you know, when we think about, or when I think about myself tanning in the summers, I might get compliments from other white women like, oh, you know, your skin looks really brown, how beautiful. But that's different than, for example, if I had been born with dark skin that couldn't be lightened. I probably wouldn't receive that same sort of praise. In fact, there probably would have been a lot of stereotypes that went along with having dark skin. So it makes it very, very different.
And I should make clear that my guest, Nikki Khanna, is mixed race. You have an Indian father and a white mother, and you are light-skinned. You write that you were shielded in many ways from colorism. How so?
So, you know, as you said, I was raised, or I have a white mother, I have an Indian father. I was primarily raised in the suburbs of Atlanta, Georgia. And for much of my life, not all of my life, but for much of my formative years, especially when I think about middle school, high school age, I lived in a predominantly white community, predominantly white schools. So I didn't have that immersion in an Asian American community at that point. But I think even what's interesting, though, is I still knew about colorism. So even while being in many ways shielded from it, I still knew all the vocabulary for skin color. I knew what weedish meant within the Indian community. I knew it was valued. I knew that light skin was favored. So I think that really speaks to the messaging that's happening within many of our communities. One of the other things I talk about in the book, and in fact, I open the book with this, is going to a local Indian grocery store and seeing whitening cream stacked on store shelves. I wouldn't even say those taught me the lesson that light skin was more valued over dark. I already knew it.
Nikki Khanna, she's a sociologist based at the University of Vermont. Her new book is Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. We'll take a short break and speak more with Nikki about her book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nikki Khanna is my guest. She is associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont. And her new book out from NYU Press is called Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. So among Asian Americans and within Asian American ethnic groups like Chinese or Indian or Filipina, you have varied skin tones. You have some women who have lighter skin and some women who have darker skin. What comes out or what has come out in the contributions to your book about questions of belonging and authenticity related to, let's say, being darker skinned than the stereotypical skin tone norm of whatever your particular ethnic group might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting about thinking about the Asian American women who contributed to this book is they really helped me see that just having any sort of deviation from the stereotypical norm of your ethnic group seemed to be problematic. So when we look at other racial groups around the world, in terms of colorism, because it affects many other racial groups, for example, we talked before about African Americans, being dark came with its problems, but it also did confer some advantage in the sense that you were seen as authentically Black or, you know, truly Black, for example. But for Asian Americans, it was a little different. So for some individuals, because they were darker than the, you know, stereotype of their ethnic group who tended to be light skinned, that was problematic. And for other groups, if they were lighter than their particular ethnic group that's tended to be stereotypically darker, that was also a problem. So women talked in sort of in two directions, you know, some saying, you know, I was too dark for my my ethnic group, and that was really problematic. And I was told I need to lighten my skin and, you know, to fit in with the archetypal image of my particular group. But for other women, it was, hey, I was actually too light. And so while they recognized there were privileges that came along with that, there were issues when it came to belonging. And some of those women were mixed race, like myself, who had white ancestry. And so they felt like, you know, I had this really light colored skin, and but my ethnic group tends to be darker, for example, if they're South or Southeast Asian. And so it created a lot of problems in terms of belonging. One of the stories that really stands out for me, and is actually one of the early contributors to the book, was a woman who was born with albinism, who's Indian American. And she talks about how, you know, people say all the time that light skin is privilege. And she said, yeah, that's true, but there's a limit. So she would talk about herself. She described herself as having blonde hair and blue eyes and really light white skin. And she found that to be really problematic in terms of connecting with other Indians and other Indian Americans and feeling like she was part of that culture. And at the same time, she strongly identified with the culture. So for her, that created a big problem. So yeah, fitting in is also another piece to this.
The psychological toll that colorism takes on Asian American women, or at least some of them, comes out in a number of essays in your book, including the essay by Cindy Lu, L-U-U. She's a Vietnamese American woman with unusually dark skin. She writes, Nikki, about getting exhausted in her efforts to live up to expectations.
Yeah, I think her story really struck me because I feel like she talked about even the physical toll. I mean, as you said, feeling exhausted, just being completely worn out by trying to keep up with the physical norms of her particular group. So for Vietnamese women, she talks about is the stereotypical norm is being petite, being light-skinned. And she said, I fit none of that. I was dark skinned. I was heavier than the average Vietnamese woman. And so she, you know, she would diet, she would knead, she would use whitening creams. And she talks about the just sheer exhaustion of trying to keep up with these beauty norms. So certainly it's that, you know, added pressure for her. And we see that physical toll really, really play out in her words.
One of the sections in your book is entitled Anti-Blackness, and you go into anti-Black racism in the U.S. And I like the fact that you don't skirt the issue of anti-Black racism among Asian Americans. Can you spell that out for us? I mean, I guess you'd have to generalize quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, and so, yeah, excuse my generalizations here, because obviously this doesn't apply to every single person, but certainly anti-Blackness is a problem within Asian American communities. And I talk about it as having two sources. One, sometimes it comes over in the baggage from Asia itself as immigrants migrate into the United States. Certainly we see a lot of anti-Black attitudes throughout Asia. I talk a lot about India and sort of the perceptions or stereotypes of Africans in India, and even the violence that they've oftentimes faced in India. But even I've talked about in this book, anti-Blackness in China, in Taiwan, and in other parts of Asia as well. So it exists there. And, you know, it's sort of been this long running question over where that anti-Blackness comes from. You know, does it have to do with lack of exposure or the little diversity within many of these Asian countries, which we could partly say, yes, maybe many Asian people just have little contact with other Black people or people from Africa, for example, and perhaps that explains some of the prejudices there. However, I do point out in the book that white people tend to have a very different experience when they're traveling throughout Asia. It's not to say that they don't face bias themselves, but generally they're oftentimes placed on a pedestal. They're seen as or people might congregate about them and ask them questions, and they're very interested in their maybe European ancestry or American ancestry. And that's something that we might say, you know, Asian people also might have little contact with white people, but they seem to treat them very differently than Black people. So I talk about one source of anti-Blackness is coming from Asia itself. And the second source is actually learning about anti-Blackness once they arrive to American shores. And I talk about the racial stereotypes, the negative racial stereotypes towards African Americans in this country. It's hard to miss them. So for Asian immigrants migrating into the U.S., they're learning these stereotypes once they arrive here as well. I talk about, you know, even the most powerful Africans, the wealthiest, they can't avoid negative or anti-blackness as well. I talk about Obama during his 8-year presidency. He was portrayed oftentimes on social media with sort of these ape and monkey-like depictions. Michelle Obama, I mentioned, she was referred to by a mayor of West Virginia as an ape in heels. And so for immigrants coming into the United States, they're learning anti-blackness norms here as well, which is extremely problematic. So it's sort of two strains or two causes, so to say.
Is it your sense that some Asian American immigrants feel like in order to move up the economic ladder, they must keep blacks down? And I also wonder whether the model minority stereotype might play into this.
Absolutely. So I do talk about this too in the book. The model minority stereotype is seemingly positive, right? This idea that yes, Asian Americans are successful and look, they work hard and they're moving up the socioeconomic ladder. The model minority myth, however, is a stereotype. So when we look at different Asian ethnic groups, we see wide variations in their successes in the United States. And a lot of that has to do with how they immigrated to the U.S. So, for example, refugees may have arrived to the U.S. Asian refugees in particular may have arrived to the U.S. with very little with them, little money, few resources. And so many of those groups have really struggled in the United States. So the model minority stereotype is extremely misleading on one hand, but also extremely damaging to the relationship of different minority groups with each other, because Asians immigrating to the United States learn about the model minority stereotype and may think, well, gosh, you know, we work hard, we're very successful, even though that's not true of all Asian ethnic groups. But look, we work hard. And so if a group doesn't achieve the same success as we do, for example, like African Americans, they must be doing something wrong. There must be something wrong with them. Maybe they don't care like we do. They don't work hard like we do, or perhaps they're more lazy or less intelligent. And so when we think about this positive model minority stereotype, it's actually fueling negative stereotypes towards African Americans as well. And of course, saying we are successful, but you know, this other group is not, is also glossing over nearly 250 years of slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and institutional discrimination that's still going on today in the United States towards African Americans. So this is extremely problematic. So I do talk about the model minority stereotype as being certainly acts as a catalyst for anti-Black bias within Asian American communities.
That's the voice of Nikki Khanna. She teaches sociology at the University of Vermont. We're talking about her new book, Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. I think you referred earlier, Nikki, to campaigns that have been taken up both here and abroad against colorism, anti-colorism campaigns. Can you tell us about a couple of them and, you know, give us a sense of the extent to which colorism is being challenged, is being confronted?
Yeah, I think that we're starting to see a shift in the way in which these topics are discussed publicly. I would say for a long time, these were topics that were not openly discussed, sort of like a secret. You know, we all knew it was there, but we didn't necessarily talk about it even with each other. But what we've seen certainly within the last 10 years are some social media campaigns, particularly coming out of South Asia, to challenge the stigmatization of dark skin. So one in particular was one that came out of India within the last 10 years called the Dark is Beautiful campaign, where you might open up a magazine and see an ad, which, you know, one in particular was something like, in a country where most of people are dark, it's, you know, sad that, you know, many of them are growing up with an inferiority complex, and it would end with stay unfair, stay beautiful. So a second campaign that has arisen out of Pakistan by a social activist, her name is Fatima Lodi, is called Dark is Divine. And what really struck me about this particular campaign is that she said when she started it, people were really kind of shocked about the campaign, and they actually didn't even really understand the purpose of the campaign. So they were really confused by the mantra Dark is Divine that she was using as the label of the campaign. And she said that, you know, people were saying to her, well, what do you mean dark is divine? How can dark be divine? And so I think that her words really show us how deeply ingrained these norms are for having or preferring light colored skin. So I think that there really is an uphill battle with regard to changing these norms and these beliefs and this sort of preference for light skin. And these are just two of these campaigns. There are several others, and we're starting to see some growing momentum among these campaigns, moving certainly beyond South Asia, but primarily to other Western nations where we might see South Asians, Southeast Asians. I haven't seen any campaigns or sort of parallel campaigns in East Asia just yet. Certainly, they may be occurring on a smaller level, or we might see them more so in the future. But it's an uphill battle. These campaigns are very progressive. They're seen as very progressive. They're positive. We need them. But they are competing with sort of this messaging that lightness is better than darkness that has occurred, as I talk about in the book, for hundreds, if not thousands of years in many of these societies. But then having said that, social media is very powerful, at least to get the message out that perhaps there's another way of thinking about skin color. So it'll be interesting to see how these unfold even in the next 5-10 years from now.
Hashtag unfair and lovely. This is a campaign that was put together by somebody in the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. This was actually a campaign that came out of the University of Texas. It was a movement inspired by an African-American student by the name of Pax Jones. And I believe he began to take pictures of some of his South Asian female classmates to sort of showcase the beauty of dark skin. But I think he's really made a point of sort of expanding this beyond South Asian communities and even among Asian-American communities to give women who have dark skin of all different races sort of a platform to say, hey, you know, I have dark skin and I'm very beautiful and hashtag unfair and lovely. So I think it started with Asian Americans, but he certainly made it even broader. And I think that that really speaks to how universal some of these themes are in many different communities.
Self-acceptance, accepting and embracing one's own skin color. This is a big theme of your book, Whiter. I mean, how important is it for women to feel emotionally healthy and secure, to feel comfortable with their own skin tone?
It's extremely important. And so women in this section talk about, you know, their childhoods or young adulthoods and sort of the battles that they've gone through throughout their lives, but also talking about how they're starting to realize, hey, you know what, I'm actually very beautiful with my dark skin, and challenging those messages, sometimes in very direct ways with mothers and grandmothers. Really interesting are two of the essays from that section. There were women who talked about how they're going to parent their children different, how they want to teach their daughters that their skin is beautiful, no matter what the shade. And I think that was really powerful because it was sort of a counterpoint to some of the essays where they talked about the pressures from their mothers. But here they were talking about how they were going to embrace their own dark skin so that their children, in particular their daughters, would be able to embrace their own beautiful dark skin as well.
You made a point of including multiracial women in your book. Why?
You know, it's interesting when we think about skin color, lightness and darkness. I think that adding women who are also multiracial, who have Asian ancestry, but white or black ancestry, those are the women that were primarily included in this book, was really important to me. One, because I shared that experience and I knew that, you know, my light skin was really a product of my white mother. And it gave me a lot of advantages and privileges. And I wanted women to speak to that, whether, for example, they were advantaged because they had white ancestry, or whether it created a sort of double or additional challenges because they had a black parent, had darker skin within their, you know, Asian ethnic community. So I believe that by including them, it added more nuance to this issue of colorism, and certainly issues of identity as well. Some of the women talked about being seen as not legitimate members of their group, not only because of their skin color, but perhaps because they had white ancestry or because they had black ancestry. And in particular, the women who contributed, who also had some degree of black ancestry, talked about or were able to sort of draw that connection between anti-blackness in their own communities and disdain for dark skin. And I thought that was extremely powerful, certainly an extremely powerful connection for us to hear.
The phenomenon of, let's say, one Asian American ethnic group shunning a darker, generally darker skinned Asian American group. So, for example, one of the contributors to your book, Julie Mizutani, says that Japanese Americans have shunned darker skinned Asian ethnic groups like Indians, Filipinexes, and Cambodians to access social benefits connected to whiteness. I mean, one, Nikki, could take in that fact with a lot of judgment toward whether it's Japanese Americans or certainly other Asian American ethnic groups that probably play out that same dynamic. I take it you would rather people not seek to judge whether it's a community or ethnic group, not to judge them, but to try to understand where these prejudices and biases are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I just want people to be educated on the ways in which colorism plays out within Asian American ethnic groups and between them. But I think also recognize this is really a global problem. So I'm specifically talking about Asian Americans and people of Asian descent, but this is something much broader. And I think the lessons we can learn in this community can be applied to other ethnic and racial groups as well. So my hope is that people walk away from this book and think about whether they're Asian American or not. And my hope is that it also touches many women and men who are not Asian American, but can see this playing out in their own communities as well. So I hope that people walk away from this sort of thinking broader as well. And I'll just also add, in terms of that thinking broader theme, my father, who you probably would hate for me to say this, but hates to read anything, is actually reading this book. And, the past couple of days he's been texting me and he's saying, I just read this essay by so-and-so. And these are all essays written by women, and it's really geared towards colorism for women. But he's saying, I actually identify with this particular essay, which is really surprising to me, but I can see those common themes even across different genders as well as being important as well. So I'm hoping a lot of people can take away, some messages from this book that they can maybe apply to their own lives.
Nikki Khanna, NIKKIKHANNA. She is a sociology professor at the University of Vermont. Her book, Biracial in America, Forming and Performing Racial Identity, created quite a stir. She's got a new book out. We've been discussing it this hour. It's called Whiter, Asian American Women on Skin Color and Colorism. The book, again, features 30 essays written by Asian American women about their experiences with skin color, bias, and discrimination and privilege in the U.S. and within their respective Asian American communities. Nikki, congratulations on this new book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, C.S. Thanks for inviting me.
And that program first aired last July 8th. And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.